Yo, smoking on top shelf Guido, and it's all over my hands like Cheetos. All she wanna do is dance in tight speedos, relax in a mansion like the Migos. I can't even sell the shit that I smoke. This shit costs bands like the Beatles. And we watch movies like it's Regal, then go cash out on seafood, send her home with a quarter ounce of diesel. Girl, that boy don't even feed you. Yeah, he's always spreading like the measles.
Hey, what's up, everyone? I know that this is not a typical release date, but I wanted to give a special secret surprise to the people who subscribe to the podcast as a special thank you for downloading. I recorded a bonus show with Dr. John Petulio, who is a diabetes expert, and it's not a full show with the full intro and everything, but I wanted to make sure I got this out to you guys as a special going into the weekend type deal. So I won't do much of a long intro, but just want to say thank you for downloading, thank you for sharing, and appreciate the support as always. This is my conversation with Dr. John Petulio. All right, welcome back to the show. You know, I one of the things that I talk about a lot on the website and I've talked about in the podcast is my family history. And the topic that we are talking about today actually hits pretty near and dear to my heart. And, you know, the state of America over the, not just this year, but over the past number of years, it's become very clear that diabetes is become quite the epidemic for Americans. And today I wanted to spend a good time talking about diabetes with an expert on this. So he's the author of Diabetes, The Real Cause, The Right Cure, 8 Steps to Reverse Your Diabetes in 8 Weeks. He's been a doctor for the past 30 years. Please welcome Dr. John Petulio. How are you, sir? How's it going?
Rich, I thank you for having me, and I thank our listeners. And I'm doing well.
Yeah, I am. You know, it's crazy to think about, one, that we're doing this virtually over Zoom, and I'm sure you're used to this, but you know, the past 6 months have been crazy. And so before we get into the topic and conversation of today's program, I wanted to ask you, how are you doing? How's the doctor doing? How have you been the last 6 months?
Well, like everybody else, we are in Portland, Oregon. Our governor is almost as active as your governor in New York. Yes. So we have been blessed with people who tell us what to do. People here are social distancing, being careful. So the incidence is there are spots, hot spots in areas.
Yeah.
So we are confined to the house mostly, but we do go out for a walk almost every day when the weather permitting. So we are coping with the situation as best as we can.
Yeah, no, I think that's kind of what we're all doing, right?
Right.
You know, we go around, we walk where we can, and we kind of try to get through it all. And yeah, I think it's important to recognize that we're all kind of in this moment together. And, you know, it's good to be grateful for having good governors that are taking this thing pretty seriously. So Dr. John, I wanted to talk a lot today, as I mentioned before, about diabetes. And I think that as one of the most common conditions that Americans face today, I think it's really important to unpack what diabetes is, because I think even for myself growing up, both of my parents are diabetic, and I never really grew up knowing what diabetes was. I kind of just knew that it was bad. And I don't think that they, as immigrants in this country, ever received the proper education on what their condition meant for them. So I'd love to start off with unpacking a little bit, from your perspective, what exactly is type 2 diabetes?
Well, let's talk about diabetes as a whole. Why is it called type 2? That means there's a type 1.
Of course.
Diabetes means elevation of blood sugar. Now, let's start with the word sugar. The sugar ordinarily means table sugar. But what is in the blood is not table sugar, but glucose. Some people get confused and they stop eating any table sugar because they feel that contributes directly to high blood glucose and their diabetes. if table sugar is the cause of diabetes, once you stop table sugar, your diabetes should go away. But it does not happen. Even if you stop, don't eat any table sugar for 20 years, you still have diabetes. So what is the role of blood glucose, which is blood sugar? Now, there's a type 1 and type 2. What's the difference? The difference is when your blood glucose level goes up, the pancreas, which is an organ in the body, releases insulin. Insulin is a hormone necessary for glucose metabolism. What does that mean? What does insulin do? Every cell in the body can use glucose to produce energy. That's the main fuel. For example, when you run, your muscles use glucose to produce energy. 80% of the glucose you consume will be used by your muscles.
Right.
But when glucose is outside the cell has no way of knowing that. Each cell is an independent living unit, just like your apartment or your home. How do you know there is somebody outside? They have to ring the doorbell. Then you know, right? But glucose has no doorbell to ring. That is the role of insulin. So insulin goes with glucose to ring the bell. That way the cell knows there is glucose outside. That does not mean automatic entry for glucose.
Right.
The cell now has to send a wagon to the door, open the door, load up glucose and bring them in. Now, suppose if you don't have insulin, glucose cannot get in.
Right.
So in type 1 diabetics, which happens in children, they don't produce insulin, glucose accumulates in the blood, and they have all kinds of problems. In the year 1920, insulin was discovered. Before that, type 1 children died by the age of 10.
Wow.
After they were given insulin, their lifespan was almost as good as normal or everyday people. Their quality of life improved. So by 1930, 1940, some of the doctors found adults with high blood sugar level. And they said, oh, this is the same thing as in children. At that time, the children's diabetes was called juvenile diabetes. Now the same thing is happening in adults. So they gave them a shot of insulin, and sure enough, their blood glucose level went down. So they were clear that it is type 2, but happening in adults. So it was at that time called adult onset diabetes.
Right.
Then something funny happened. Somebody discovered a test to measure insulin in the blood. And to their surprise, they found adults have insulin already in the blood. At the time of diagnosis, some of them have even more than normal insulin.
Okay.
And that created a problem. If insulin is there, how can blood sugar be high? They could not find out a reason. And if you take the insulin molecule, it is structurally the same. It is functionally the same. So there's nothing wrong with the molecule. So they had to come up with an answer. They could say, well, it is not a hormonal disease. It is not an insulin-based disease. But then you will lose your clients, right?
Right, of course.
So in 1940, a doctor in Vienna suggested, maybe it is not the problem of insulin. It is the cells are not responding to insulin.
Okay.
So the theory of insulin resistance was born. Is that clear?
Yeah, no, it's clear. So essentially in the type 2 in adults, it is the theory is that the cells are insulin resistant, right?
If you look at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disease website today, after the interview, check it out. They will say type 2 diabetes usually begins when muscle, liver, and fat cells do not use insulin well.
Right.
They're essentially insulin resistance. They are resisting.
Right.
But I have a problem with that.
Okay.
Now, in any science, if somebody proposes a hypothesis, before it is accepted as fact, it has to be validated through a three-step process. The first is called logic. Does this make sense?
Yeah, right, right.
In our body, we have 200 different types of cell. Why only these three are not responding to insulin? It's as if they formed a union one day and said, no, we are not going to respond to insulin anymore. Why? And body has so many hormones. Why did they choose insulin in particular? Does it make sense?
Right, right.
It did not make sense to me.
No, no.
The second is, after logic, in any hypothesis to be accepted, you need to show a mechanism. As I mentioned earlier, insulin rings the doorbell. So right. Is it a problem with the doorbell not ringing? Or the message is not going to the gene? Or the gene is incapacitated? Or the execution of the gene instruction is not done? Or is it the same problem in each of these three sites?
Right.
Nobody knows the mechanism of the defect, the non-responsiveness. Why is it happening at that particular time? What's the mechanism whereby the message is blocked? The third, most important in any hypothesis, measurement. You have to have a way to measure. For example, if you are newly diagnosed or if you have had type 2 diabetes for 20 years, is the degree of insulin resistance the same? If you have complications, are you getting more resistant? There's no test.
Right.
If you inject somebody with insulin, blood glucose goes down. Where does it go? Does it go into the cell that was resistant before? Or does it go into a cell that is not resistant, sensitive? How does that help? So, can you now accept the theory of insulin resistance?
No, probably not. To me, it seems that the conclusions were come up sort of prematurely. And I think that as we're starting to learn more, and like you're saying, as you start to pick at the bones a little bit, you start to realize that the thoughts are sort of incomplete there.
Exactly. That is what I want to bring attention to. I'm not selling anything. I'm not selling any tablets or gadgets or anything. All I'm saying is there's something wrong with this science. We need to start asking questions. When the doctor, let me ask you this question. Suppose you are resistant to an antibiotic. Sure. Will you take the same antibiotic for an infection?
No.
But if you are resistant to insulin, what do you take? What are you given?
You're probably given insulin.
Right. But how does that work? What's the logic?
That's interesting. I think part of it has to do with, one, the pharmaceutical, but also the medical industry in the United States in particular, and probably globally too, though I'm not as familiar with how medicine works overseas, that we tend to be a system here where we reward trying to treat a disease, but and kind of keeping people in the loop rather than fixing the problem as a whole.
You got it correct. That's exactly happening not only here, everywhere in the world. When a patient comes to the doctor, the doctor feels obligated to do something. Right. The easiest way is to write a prescription. So that is common everywhere in the world.
Yeah. I want to take a step back for a second because part of this show, and I imagine some of my listeners might have diabetes, but there's also a lot of folks who don't. And I think I want to get to sort of what's causing this a little bit more, so we could sort of treat this conversation not only as a potential treatment, but also how we can start to talk about preventative measures, because I think that that's something that's not talked about in our medical system. Our doctor doesn't necessarily teach us how to prevent these things.
So this is just an introduction to what I propose as my hypothesis. As you mentioned in my book, the name of my diabetes, The Real Cause and the Right Cure. So I cannot just say what the doctors are doing wrong or the concept is wrong, but I have to come up with the answer. Then what is it?
Right, yeah.
Let me start with the role of glucose. As I mentioned, your muscles use glucose to produce energy.
Yep.
If that muscle is resistant to insulin and glucose is not getting in, you would expect the muscles should not be functioning. There has to be a functional defect. But most people, when they are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, they have no problem running, walking. There are basketball players who play basketball or golfing, dancing. So that means
weightlifters,
the muscles are producing energy. How could that be? Our muscles are like a hybrid car. A hybrid car can run on gasoline or electricity. If you have not eaten all day, you can still run and play and act, do your work, because your muscles are producing energy. So what is the fuel the muscle is using? The muscle can use fatty acid as an alternate fuel. In fact, most of our energy during the everyday life comes from fatty acid, not from glucose.
Right.
Because our base level of glucose is very low. So glucose is used as a kindling agent in the muscle, and the muscles primarily use fatty acid to produce energy.
Right.
Where is the fatty acid coming from? Fatty acid is produced in the liver. What is the raw material the liver uses to produce fatty acid? Liver uses excess glucose coming from the food. Where is the glucose coming from? If you take modern day diet, most of the energy in the modern day diet comes from grain or grain flour products.
Yeah.
Okay. 100 years ago, the amount of energy humans got from carbohydrate or grains was less than 35% of total daily energy intake. Today, it is at least 50 to 70%. Let me ask you this question. When is the last time you had a meal or a snack without a grain flour product?
I'll say that I am I'm vegan, so I a lot of my meals contain a grain of some sort.
Right. The quantity, the only reason you lost weight, I would submit, will be you cut down the amount of grain-based foods.
Oh yeah.
So all that is what I'm asking people to do primarily. If you don't put in your mouth the source of glucose, the liver cannot convert the excess. See, the liver can hold on only 120 grams of glucose.
Right.
And there is no storage area for glucose. So it has to be converted into fat or fatty acid for storage.
Yeah. Now, is that only for average adults, or is that highly active adults as well? Because I think one of the things that I read a lot, especially more for diets around active adults, is that it's okay if it's a little bit higher, because your body is using that as a more efficient source of energy for your exercises.
After your meal, in about 4 hours, everything is digested and absorbed into the body.
Yeah.
That is when insulin goes with the glucose molecules to every cell in the body 30 to 32 trillion cells. It is insulin that knocks on the door and tells the cell there is glucose outside.
Yeah.
Once they have accepted what they need, the leftover will come back to the liver. And the liver will process it because there is no storage. Just to give you an example, after supper, you can check your blood glucose level. It will be high if you had any carbohydrate-based meals.
Yeah.
But if you take it in the morning, 12 hours later, your glucose level has gone down back to normal. So where did it go? The liver converted that into fatty acid. And these fatty acids, three molecules of fatty acid will be connected to a molecule of glycerol. And then that compound is called triglyceride. That's the fancy name for the fat that you store.
Okay.
That's what you lost a whole lot of.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that I think that makes sense. I think what I'm curious about is the problem mostly grain-based foods, or is this all carbohydrates, right? Like, do we lump in potatoes into that? Do the carbohydrates from lentils or beans, do they have the same sort of nature?
Yes, it is the same, but in the modern day diet, it is the grain-based carbohydrate that is causing the problem. Because 100 years ago, people ate potatoes and sweet potatoes and all of those.
Right.
The best example, well, let me finish up this narration and then you ask me the example, okay?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, I told you about the triglyceride, which is the fat.
Yeah.
The liver sends that to the fat cell.
Okay.
But in the fat, the triglyceride or the fat molecule cannot enter the fat cell. There it is chopped up into fatty acid back. And the fatty acid can enter the fat cell. And there the fat cell produces another glycerol molecule to reconstitute the fat or triglyceride and store it. Now, imagine if you will, that your fat storage capacity is filled up. You may have inherited, say, 20-pound fat storage capacity. Your neighbor may have 50-pound fat storage capacity. By the way, that is what you are inheriting from your parents. There is no diabetic gene. Otherwise, you would have been a diabetic by now.
Right,
if your
right.
parents had diabetes, if you had inherited a gene, you would have been a diabetic.
Right.
But what you inherited was the fat storage capacity. When that fat storage capacity is filled up, the fatty acid that liver produces, fatty acid, will stay in the blood. When the fatty acid level goes up, muscles switch to fatty acid because fatty acid can easily enter the muscle. It does not need insulin. It does not need any help because muscle wall is made of fat. So cholesterol and fat. So fatty acid can enter, it can feed the fuel, it can give the fuel to the muscle machinery. It does not need glucose. So when glucose comes in, the insulin announces there is glucose outside, muscle is saying, I'm already full. I have enough fuel. I don't need it. That's why glucose stays in the blood.
Okay. I think that makes sense.
If you have a young lady, no family history of diabetes. She becomes pregnant. 8 weeks, her blood sugar starts going up. She's called gestationally diabetic. Why? Because she's encouraged to eat for two people. And she starts eating.
Yeah.
Her friends will say, oh, this is good for complexion. This is good for brain. This is good for muscles. This is good for bones. And she eats and eats. And she fills up her fat storage capacity. And her blood sugar starts going up. After delivery, she loses weight. Now she has emptied out some fat cells. The glucose can now be stored as fat and blood sugar goes down to normal. Hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
That is what is happening. Now you may have a neighbor who weighs 250 or 300 pounds with normal blood glucose.
Yeah.
Why? Because he inherited a huge fat storage capacity. He can gain 100 pounds of weight and still can have normal blood sugar because he has the storage capacity. In the United States, 85% of type 2 diabetics are considered obese. In India, 60% of type 2 diabetics are not obese.
Huh.
60%. Why? Because for generations, we have been lean people.
Yeah.
So.
I'm curious if the presence then is of the specific grains, right? Like is all rice bad for you? Like is the presence of rice in your diet not a thing that we should have?
It is the quantity.
Okay.
It is the quantity. There is nothing wrong with rice or wheat or corn or potato. Everything in the body, once it is digested, will be absorbed as glucose. Any carbohydrate will be absorbed as glucose, or most of the digestible carbohydrate. There is some resistant carbohydrate. That's a different story.
Right, right.
So
I think that's a really important point, and sorry to interrupt you. I think that's a particularly important point because I think one of the things that people have a lot of trouble grasping around either diets in general or trying to create lifestyle changes is the fact that they seem to get intimidated thinking that they have to cut everything out. And based off of what you're saying, my understanding is that no, you should reduce the amount of grains in your diet and you should limit it. But if you, for example, want to still enjoy the food of your culture, I'm Mexican, so there's a lot of like tortillas as an example in our diet. But maybe I should have less tortillas. Maybe I should have less rice and focus more on things like vegetables and fruit and, you know, beans rather than those other things that are potentially a lot more harmful.
Let me ask you two questions. One is, sure. If you take a tortilla by itself, or you eat, boil some rice, can you enjoy it by itself?
No.
Why not? So what exactly are you enjoying when you eat it?
It's the whole meal together.
Right. So if you add some meat or some gravy, you are actually enjoying the meat or the gravy. So are you not diluting the enjoyment by adding tortilla to it?
Well, you know, like the tortilla helps you like carry it.
Right. So why do you want to reduce your enjoyment?
That's fair.
Okay.
That's interesting.
So what I'm asking people to do it for 8 weeks, cut down the amount of intake of your grain-based food to one half of what you're doing. Just one half.
Yeah.
Take more time to chew. Enjoy the same amount. The enjoyment does not come from tortilla. We established that.
Right.
So it should not diminish your enjoyment of the meal. And it is the tortilla and the rice that gives you trouble. It is only a carrier of your enjoyment. So cut down the carrier. In fact, that will increase the enjoyment part, theoretically, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that is all I'm asking.
One of the things I saw a nutritionist for a little bit when I was on my weight loss journey. One of the things that I see often, and this is something I talk to people about, is essentially the easy way to think about this. Because I think part of the problem for folks is that they get a bit overwhelmed. So one of the ways that I've seen, and you can tell me if you disagree or you think differently, is thinking about your plate is in being in thirds, right? Like one third being your protein, one third being your vegetable, and the last third being your carbohydrate, whether that be your potato, your grain, whatever that might be. And essentially working your way from green to protein and then sort of ending up at the grains. Is there another method that you would suggest, or do you think that that's a good sort of way to go about it?
The problem with that method is you have already decided how much you are going to eat.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. Suppose I bring you, I see you're drinking, sipping water. You bring you 12 ounces of water right now. How much will it take to quench your thirst? Can you predetermine?
No. I don't.
How long will it take to quench your thirst? How many sips?
I don't know.
When you are drinking, it won't take more than a couple of minutes, right?
Right, yeah.
By the time you finish drinking, your thirst is quenched. The water you drank is still in your stomach. It has not been absorbed into the body yet.
Right.
You have been working out, you will drink more.
Yeah,
in other words,
a lot more.
You cannot predetermine the quantity of water that will take to quench your thirst. Okay?
Yeah.
The mechanism is the same for food also. But if you already predetermined, how can it help you? Let me give you an example. Do you have any toddlers, your nieces, nephews, children, whatever?
Yeah, I have nephews that are a little younger.
If you watch toddlers, how toddlers eat, you'll observe three things. One, they eat only when they are hungry.
Yes.
Second, they pick and choose what they enjoy eating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Third, when they are done, they could care less what is left on the plate. They would rather go out and play.
Right.
So they don't clean their plate, so to speak. They grow up normal by deciding what to eat, when to eat, how much to eat. If they can do that, why can't we?
Yeah. I think, especially for me, growing up a little bit on the lower income side, my mom, I think, always made sure that we didn't waste food because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. And so I think the thing that I was taught, and I'm sure a lot of people out there are taught, is that you finish all your food because I don't want to waste food. I worked hard to put that food on the table. And we're almost doing harm by socializing that within us, that we feel guilty. Obviously, food waste is a big problem, but we also shouldn't force ourselves to, you know, consume more than we should.
I grew up in India. And after I came here, I've been here since 1970. I counseled 10 American adults who are overweight. And I told them, while growing up in India, certain days I did not feel any hungry. So I didn't have to eat. And I thank you for it because you were eating for me, starving children in India and China. But the problem is, once they start it, they cannot stop it. And I asked these 10 people, write down for 3 days the exact time you felt hunger and the exact time you ate. 4 out of 10 never felt hungry for 3 days. But that didn't stop them from eating. Right?
Yeah.
I asked them,
yeah, it's true. Eating is almost a habit.
Right. I asked them, why did you eat if you're not hungry? And their reply was, it was time to eat. Okay, so you get conditioned. Okay. And do you know when that conditioning starts? At age 6. Why? Because that is when you start listening to your parents. You better eat it because we are traveling. Yeah. We don't have food. I worked hard for it, just like you said.
Yeah.
And that is where it starts.
I'm curious about your opinion based off of what you're mentioning around in the grains in particular. A lot of fad diets come into the marketplace and hit the internet and hit mainstream a lot. And particularly the two I keep coming back to, based off of some of the stuff I've read in your book and what you're saying now, are one, the ketogenic diet, and the second being the Whole 30 diet. I'd love to start with your thoughts on the keto diet, because I think that people oftentimes come to this one, and based off of what you're saying, it sounds like this might be beneficial for some folks out there.
To me, it doesn't matter what type of diet what you want to use, as long as you are in charge. For example, when you sit down to eat, well, let me back up a little bit. Human body needs 100 different nutrients for healthy functioning, 100. When you sit down to eat, do you know what your body is looking for? What nutrient?
No.
Then how can anybody else know?
That's fair.
So how can you say, I'm going to eat that diet or this diet because there's so much claim of it. But the problem is when you sit down to eat, you don't know what your body is looking for, what nutrient is missing, and what how much of that nutrient is present in that particular food at that particular time. Again, I go back to the toddlers. They don't know any of these things. But if they can do it, why can't we?
I'm curious about your how you think people can help manage their cravings, right? Because I think one of the things in particular, one, as someone who it took me a while to lose weight and struggled with weight, something I hear a lot from my friends who still struggle with weight and family is the craving portion. And it's, well, I don't want to cut this out because I get cravings, or I can deal with this diet for like 2 weeks and then my cravings start to kick in. How do you suggest people start to work through some of that?
Well, let's go to the second part. I can go through this diet for 2 weeks and then the cravings kick in.
Yeah.
Why? Because the diet that you have been following did not provide the nutrients at the right time to the body, and the body is saying, I need it. And your brain will identify, actually your subconscious brain will identify in the past what foods provided that particular nutrient your body needed. And it makes a record of that. Just to give you an example. Let's say we go to a Chinese buffet. There are 100 items. We are going for lunch.
Yeah.
How many will you choose?
Probably going to choose a lot of the most expensive thing that's there.
How many? Give me a number.
I'll probably say like 3, 4 maybe.
Let's say 4. And
based
on what?
What looks good?
Is it looks good or based on your previous experience with it, you have enjoyed it before, otherwise you wouldn't take it. So first you know what they are, two, you know how much you enjoyed it, so you take 3, 4, 5, okay, and you will sit down, you'll enjoy it. Suppose we go back to the same buffet for supper, will you take exactly the same 5?
No.
Why not? You enjoyed it for lunch, why can't you enjoy it for now, for supper?
I already had it before. Probably can get, I don't want to get tired of it.
Why? Why did you get tired of it?
Because I already had it.
The nutrients that your body absorbed from the lunchtime, they have not been used up. But there is a deficiency of other nutrients that your subconscious brain knows where it is present in some other food. That is the subconscious mind tells you, the conscious brain, okay, that looks good, this looks good, that one, no, we had it, something else. So you feel that you are voluntarily choosing it for variety. But what I'm saying is there's a physiological basis for that action.
Yeah.
So if you listen to your own body, your own brain, it is capable of doing it. You have been ignoring it for the sake of quote-unquote enjoyment or pleasure. You have become addicted to certain way of eating.
Yeah, but part of me feels like it's physiological, but also part of me feels like it's psychological as well. And I think that especially this year, I'll say, we sometimes go to food for comfort. And sometimes food has very emotional, causes very emotional responses within us. Mm-hmm. And so I think we get like very emotionally attached to these things.
Absolutely. Not only food, there are other activities that we do become emotionally attached. Yeah. Now, let's go back to the enjoyment part.
Yeah.
If you take a bite of food, how much of that food do you really enjoy?
I'm not sure.
Only the portion that comes in contact with your taste buds you can enjoy.
Yeah.
So if you put a stack of it, take a big bite, four times and swallow, you have not enjoyed 90% of it.
Yeah, because you're just focused on
right. Eating. If you are concentrating on watching TV or on the conversation, your brain, conscious part of the brain, cannot concentrate on more than one thing at a time.
Yeah. And I'll say the big problem these days are these things. I'm showing my phone.
Right.
The people eating with the phone, I do it all the time, unfortunately. And it's just like, I have to remind myself to put my phone down so I'm not paying attention to
it. So you are not concentrating on the enjoyment part. No, you're eating for enjoyment, but you're not enjoying what you're eating. Let me ask you this question. In nature, how many foods are there that humans can eat without chewing?
Oh, not any at all.
Unless you take honey.
Right.
Why? What is the reason?
I'm not sure.
Remember, we went back earlier, we talked about drinking and quenching.
Yeah.
How did the brain know when to create the sensation of quenching? How did the brain know that when it had enough water?
Yeah, when it felt satiated from that.
How did the water, the quantity is different. Your stomach can hold 1 liter of water. But you don't drink a liter each time. In other words, you don't fill up your stomach. Way before that, your brain told you had enough. Why? Because as the water is going down, the taste buds are sending the message to the brain, not only what you are drinking, but how much is going down. It is metering.
Yeah.
The brain already knows how much your deficit is. When the intake matches the deficit, it creates the sensation of quenching. Satisfaction. There's a similar mechanism for nutrients also, but the taste buds cannot register it unless it is the nutrients are released in a timed fashion. That is where the chewing comes in. When you chew, the release mechanism, the rate of release is enough for the brain, for the taste buds to register and the brain to record. So, if you are pureeing your food, if you are blending your food, if you're drinking your food nutrients, it won't work. So you have to take time to chew.
Right.
But nowadays, people are so, they don't have time. They eat so fast. Right. That's the number one cause of overeating. You don't take time. Second, you don't enjoy what you're chewing and eating. Your enjoyment is something else. You're eating so that you can do something else. You just want to get it over with. You're too busy to enjoy. There's no other activity in your life that you can do multiple times a day and still enjoy each time. There's no other activity. Even sex, you cannot do that so many times.
Oh, great. That's wonderful. No, and I'll say what's interesting about the drinking your food thing. I have a blender that I use a lot, and I drink a lot of smoothies. I'll say that I drink smoothies because it's easy, and it's the easiest thing for me to do in the morning. But I'll say that I do not enjoy the process of drinking my smoothie as much as I do, you know, like sitting down for a proper meal. I'm not thinking about that smoothie as much.
Yes, that's exactly my point. How can your brain know how much is going down? All you have to do is when you drink water, you pour it down the throat, you'll end up drinking more. compared to sipping.
Right.
So the how you eat matters.
Right, right. What do you think is the biggest thing that people collectively over, you know, the past 30 or so years that you've been doing this, that people have to work on, that is sort of the biggest problem that you see out there? Is it the grains?
There are two things. One, the grains, because they are the cheapest food available.
Fair.
The government, yeah. Every government is subsidizing grain farming one way or another. And in the United States, we give $25 billion farm subsidy. Most of it goes to grain. So yeah. All the cheapest food available, the most conveniently packaged food available are all, or most of them are, almost all of them are made with grains.
Yeah.
So that is why when you are young, your parents worked hard, they got the money. If they want to feed you well, so to speak, grain-based foods will be the cheapest way to go. And
right.
They feel good, you finish it. When you finish it, they feel good. So
right.
That is number one problem. The second is we are not enjoying, we don't have time to enjoy the meal properly. We are in a hurry all the time. There are so many things to do. So if you don't sit down, chew the food properly, enjoy it without distraction. If you're watching TV, if you're on your cell phone, how can you enjoy the food? So
right.
These are the two problems, the grain-based cheap foods and not having time to enjoy what you eat.
Yeah. I want to take a second based off of what you just said to talk about low-income communities
right.
in general, right? You grew up in India. I grew up here in New York City in the South Bronx in a pretty poor neighborhood. And I think for people from lower income, there is this perception that healthy food is expensive and being able to deal with these kinds of health problems is an expensive thing to embark on. So how do you think that in the cheapest way possible, people can address their health through their eating?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, right now, you have to start cutting back on grain-based foods to one half of what you have been eating.
Okay.
That's the number one. Now, what has happened is, since, you know, in water, when you're drinking, you mentioned the word satiation.
Yeah.
In food eating also, there is satiation, there is fullness. You are right. Not paying attention to satiation. What happens is if you are hungry, that first bite of food tastes so good, right? After about 5-10 minutes, the food doesn't taste as good.
Yeah.
Yet you continue eating because you are conditioned to finish it, whether you eat, whether you enjoy it or not. Just like in the case of water, suppose you stop eating, just like the toddlers do. When they stop enjoying the food, they stop eating. If you do that, then you can control the intake. Now, as I also mentioned, you need 100 different nutrients. You need a variety, and all of that are available in vegetables and fruits and nuts.
Right.
And you can have animal products if you want to, but you don't need to.
Right.
So the question is, do you have access to all the variety of vegetables and fruits and nuts that you need? You can supplement that with mushrooms, herbs, and spices, because they all contain different nutrients. That is how to go about, because the quantity. What happens is when you don't pay attention to the satiation part, the backup part is the fullness.
Yeah.
Then you get used to, or you keep eating until your stomach feels full. And if you do that, you are in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll say that the spicing of the food is probably the key to get you to enjoy your vegetables the most, right? Like, and making sure that you, and this is actually the problem with with people. So if you're cooking, you're not going to eat a chicken breast if you eat meat. You're not going to eat a chicken breast plain.
Right.
That's not enjoyable.
Right.
So you got to make sure that you spice your vegetables too, and that you're not just boiling them or blanching them, because that's not enjoyable. That's not a great thing to do. One of the best things I've discovered actually in the past number of years, me and my girlfriend love going to go eat Indian food, actually. And what we realized is that in Indian food, there's a lot of great vegetables that are cooked in these great spices and these great sauces. And, you know, I feel like for the most part, Indian food is pretty healthy.
It is. Let me ask you this. If somebody gives you sawdust, you won't enjoy it. But
right.
Why are spices enjoyable? Because each spice has some nutrient your body needs. If there was no needed nutrient, the brain will not create the sensation of enjoyment.
Right.
So that is why when you have different spices, you are getting nutrients. Your brain says, this is good, give it to me. And when the intensity of that enjoyment goes down, the brain is saying, I had enough. But once you pay money for it, you cannot stop.
Yeah, that's true. Take your doggy bag and then take it home, eat it the next day. You don't have to eat it all at once.
Exactly. That is, and if you are, you know, going for a buffet, it is one price fits all. You want to get your money's worth.
Yeah, well, you're right.
So all that mindset has to change, just like it changed for you.
Right.
That is what we have to teach people. And what I would like your listeners to do is, if they are already diabetic, ask the doctor, why am I taking this medication? What does it do? Where does that sugar go? Because what I have seen is, I have had my relatives who had both legs amputated in spite of keeping A1C below 7 with medication. I have had friends who had kidney damage, heart damage, Alzheimer's, cancer, in spite of keeping blood sugar below A1C 7. So what is the medication doing? How does it help? If you're going to have the same complication, you have a right to know what happens to that glucose that goes out of the blood. It does not go out of the body.
Right. Yeah, no, and I think that the important thing to keep in mind is that medicine is not the easy thing to solve the problem. And especially with the state of medicine and the medical system in our country and the world, is that it's built to sort of keep you. And it rewards keeping people in the cycle. And so I think there is a certain level of control that you have to take for yourself.
Exactly.
In order, one, to understand, but two, to try to find a solution for this.
I agree with you 100%. The whole process of my writing is to empower the person. The person has to be in charge of his or her own body. Only the person's brain knows what nutrients, when, and how much.
Yeah.
Nobody else can tell you. They can give you general directions what you need. But the quantity has to be yours to determine.
Right, and it's interesting because we're my girlfriend's a teacher, and you're taught in school from when you're a little kid that we have evolved as humans to be able to survive, right?
Exactly.
And the feelings of cravings, the feelings of being satiated, the feelings of desiring certain nutrients are things that have evolved in humans over thousands upon thousands of years to be able to survive. And in order for us to continue to live and in order for us to be able to live fruitful, healthy lives, we need to listen to it.
Exactly. And that's all you need. Just listen to your own brain. It will tell you what to do, when to do, how much. Just like in the case of thirst and quenching. The brain creates a sensation of thirst. And you have no way of knowing when your next sensation of hunger is going to come, what time. You cannot predict
it. Right.
but your brain knows.
No, that's incredibly important. Well, Dr. John, this has been absolutely incredible. I felt like I learned an insane amount. I hope the listeners learned a great amount. For the listeners out there, you know, if you want to learn more about diabetes, both from a preventative perspective, but also if you have diabetes, being able to take that power into your own hands, I recommend you picking up Dr. John's book. That's Diabetes, The Real Cause, The Right Cure, 8 Steps to Reverse Your Diabetes in 8 Weeks. I also recommend you go visit drjohnonhealth.com. I read some of his writing on there, and it's really great stuff. And Dr. John, it's very clear that you know what you're talking about and that you've been doing this for quite some time. So thank you so much for sharing with my listeners today.
I thank you for having me. As you mentioned, the books are available on Amazon. I have written 4 books altogether. Instagram and Facebook, Dr. John on Health, or my website, drjohnonhealth.com. Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course. Well, you take care, sir, and hope everyone enjoyed the show. I will see you next week.
Thank you.
Yo, listen, I said I came from the bottom. You an elevator, baby. The struggle made us humble and genuinely crazy. Yo, silver spoon, never. I was raised in the living room. All day smoking haze, praying that I get it soon. I took a nigga pack when I was broke. Almost 20 with no money, up in college lacking hope. Had the whole dorm clicking. You know niggas gotta smoke. Wiping out the competition. Ain't no David had the dope. Couldn't walk in my butters. They only fit G's. Nigga, my wrist freeze. Niggas play Superman and get Chris Reeve. All from a text message. I have your girl on you. You be stretched out before you send your next message. I don't like niggas. Beat around the bush for what? I'm really nice, nigga. Axe around and look them up. I'm in a deli with a bottle trying to see what's goody. Yeti side streets cold. You gon' need
your okay, money. None of y'all niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride. Said all my niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride. I feel like a precious pebble lodged under the sea. Since I was 8, I knew a 9-to-5 wasn't for me. Shit ain't always how you want it to be. That's why I gotta work hard. My ancestors had to run to be free. At 15, I was running the streets. Drinking liquor, puffing the greets. Cutting from school, fucking with freaks. By 21, I was sunk in the seat. G-Ride, bumping some beats. Probably looking for something to eat. During my childhood, nothing was sweet. I wore ponies to school. The mother niggas had ups on their feet. It never fazed me though. I knew I was more intelligent. And the gift I had made it even more relevant. When I rap, I touch many like a known therapist. Cause I'm packed with more passion than a gold medalist. I say something, they gon' jack it, nigga. No letterman. I can pop at any time. Shit, there's no telling it. Okay, none of y'all niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride. Said all my niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride.